iTunes International. From the golden sands of Bondi Beach across your world.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around your world. If it's not Taylor Swift's world, that is. I'm Henry in Sydney, and I'm joined by Harriet, who's also in Sydney. Welcome to the show, Harriet. You're 12 years old, is that right?
Yes, I'm turning 13 this year.
Ah, the big teenager time for you. Now, look, I'm interested to know about Taylor Swift from you. Yeah. What is it that you like about Taylor Swift? What is it with Taylor Swift that's different for you?
I think I like how all of her albums have this sort of diversity, and you can listen to so many different albums and feel so many different emotions. And I think her lyrics and her sound just creates this amazing world that you're put into when you listen to her. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Now, I get the feeling that you're excited about something. Let me think about this. Oh, yes. Harriet, what are you doing tomorrow?
I'm going to the Eras Tour.
Taylor Swift?
Yep.
In Sydney?
Mm-hmm.
Are you excited?
I'm very excited.
You know what? I'm just wondering, you know, are there boys in your school?
Yes, there are.
Do they like Taylor Swift?
I think I've met like one other boy who likes Taylor Swift. Otherwise, whenever I mention her, they go on a rant about how much they hate her, or for crazy reasons that they like make up, like she has a factory in Asia.
Uh-oh. That's yeah. Gonna, yeah. What do you think about that? Does that concern you?
Yes, I mean, I feel like people are being fed false information so many times about these sorts of celebrities. And especially since it's happening to Taylor so much, I feel like there should be more awareness about how much fake information is being spread around.
Yeah. You mean like on social media, like Instagram and so on?
Yeah.
Are you any exactly. on any of these social medias sites?
No, I'm not. But I get my information mostly either from my friends or if I search it up. So, yeah.
Right. Now, I happen to know that there are 250 trains being put aside for fans going out to Olympic Park in the western suburbs of Sydney this weekend. And that's just today. And there's 600 buses. You know, how are you getting there, by the way?
I'm catching public transport with one of my friends because I'm going with her and her family. So, yeah, we thought taking a car would be too much of a hassle.
Yeah, I reckon. I reckon you should just cycle. It'd be good for the environment, and it might be faster than the 250 trains and the 600 buses. What do you reckon?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to be with 100,000 people. I can imagine the audience. Can you imagine yourself, the audience that you're going to be amongst tomorrow as you see Taylor Swift in the flesh?
Yeah, it's going to be crazy, I think. I think it will be one of the most surreal moments of my life because I've seen her on screen so much and her being in person and with all of these fans who like her just as much as I do around, it's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I find it interesting that, actually, you know what? You're lucky you live in Sydney, and I'll tell you why. Because two flights carrying the fans of Taylor Swift have been cancelled from Brisbane. And they paid $1,500 for a flight to Sydney one way. So, you know, you may have some difficulty getting to the stadium because there's so many people going, but at least you're not in Brisbane, Harriet.
Yeah.
Now, tell me more about the words of Taylor's songs. You mentioned very succinctly at the beginning of this interview that you do listen to the words, because when I was a kid, I never listened to the words of songs. Do you think that she has a very positive impact on everyone, not just young people?
Yeah, I think it goes around for all ages. I've seen so many people come out and they're like, I'm like 52 and I listen to Taylor, and I feel like she's created such a huge impact on everyone's lives, and like her lyrics can have so much meaning in them. Like, even if you're not a fan of her production or her voice, you have to admit that her lyrics are what makes her special. Like, in her documentary, Miss Americana, she talks about how she feels like every artist has a sort of clique that they fit into.
I'm trying to be as educated as possible on how to respect people, on how to deprogram the misogyny in my own brain, toss it out, reject it, and resist it. Like, there is no such thing as a slut. There is no such thing as a bitch. There is no such thing as someone who's bossy. There's just a boss. We don't want to be condemned for being multifaceted. Sorry, that was a real soapbox.
No, oh
why did
God,
I say sorry? You're just...
It's because we're trained to say sorry.
Yeah, we legitimately are. We're like, sorry, was I loud? In my own house that I bought with the songs that I wrote about my own life.
And she says, if it weren't for like my songwriting, my lyrics, then I wouldn't be here today. And I feel like that's just such a special part of her music and how it connects to all ages and all races all around the world.
Wow. Are you sure you didn't recite this? You are so good to interview. You make my job so easy, I should say. So when you're there, do you expect any sort of change in view or whatever when you see her in you know, for real on the stage? And do you have a position in the audience where you can?
Well, I'm not going to be on the floor because those tickets will cost a bajillion dollars.
Yeah, yes.
Know that I'm still going to have such an amazing time seeing her. Even if I'm like up at the top of the stands, I think it's still such an amazing experience. Even if you're not like a meter away from her, you still get to feel that positive energy around.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, I'm so excited for you. I just wonder, did you have a star like Taylor that was your favorite, I guess, before Taylor?
Well, I've always loved Olivia Rodrigo, and I remember listening to Katy Perry's like really early songs when I was
wow.
I just remember watching all of these music videos, Taylor included, like the Shake It Off music video, the Blank Space music video. And I feel like whenever I re-watch them, I have this sort of sense of nostalgia, because I think about when I was little and like it had just come out. Well, not just come out, but it wasn't as old as it is now. Mm. And just seeing how much all of these artists have grown is just amazing to be here.
Yeah, I bet. As a matter of interest, were you a fan of Justin Bieber? Or is that too yesterday for you, Harriet?
Well, I listened to a couple of his songs, but I've never really been very obsessed over boy bands or male artists. I'm not sure why. I've always sort of leaned towards the female artists more. But yeah, I think he's an amazing artist.
Do you think you're a feminist?
Well, yes, obviously.
I know that's a really difficult question to ask someone, yeah. Because you kind of think, oh God, if I say I'm a feminist, they're going to put me in this little box.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Well, obviously, I believe in women's rights, mm-hmm. and I think that equality is very important, especially like for Australia. And yeah, I wouldn't say I'm like a die-hard feminist. I won't be going to these protests, but I definitely believe that everyone should have equal rights. So.
Good for you. Now, do you the way you dress, is that affected, let's say, by Taylor's way of dressing?
Well, I don't dress like her, but I do wear like her merchandise sometimes or things that are related to her. Like right now I'm wearing my 1989 cardigan.
1989.
Yeah, the Taylor's version cardigan that she released when she released it when she released 1989 Taylor's version. And like I wear sometimes Taylor themed shirts or maybe other artists sort of merchandise. So, yeah.
I know we've got listeners who are wondering where you're getting this stuff from. Where are you getting this stuff from?
Well, sometimes I get stuff off like Etsy if they just have a Taylor themed shirt or an Olivia Rodrigo themed shirt, but usually I get it off Taylor's website, even though it's a hunk of money. I usually
Yeah.
save for it, and yeah, that's how I wear all of this stuff now.
Cool. Okay, now what's your favorite currently? Because it'll probably change as Taylor releases new material. What's your current favorite song of Taylor Swift's?
Well, my all-time favorite Taylor song is You're Losing Me, the one that she released back in December. It was unreleased before. It was on a CD and you could only get it like that. Then she released it and I played it so much. It's just, I've never, obviously, I've never been in a relationship. I'm 12. But I think that somehow I connect to the lyrics, even though I've never been in a situation like that. I feel like Taylor has the power to do that with fans, so.
Well, you seem very much like a smart young lady. You know that, that song, You're Losing Me, do you think that represents, and I'll ask you this because you're mature enough to be asked, do you think that represents her relationships that she's had problems with in the past?
Yes, I mean, You're Losing Me could be about any, it could be about a friendship or relationship, but everyone kind of knows that it's about Joe Alwyn, the actor that she dated for 6 years, and I was devastated when they broke up. But
Really?
yeah, because she, you
You
know, she
felt
wrote.
for her, didn't you?
Yeah, she wrote Lover about him, like a full album. And I was like, it's sad, but we can't really do anything about
No,
it.
no,
Now it's
no.
happened, like it's their lives.
Yeah,
So.
for sure. Well, we'll play that song after this interview. I'm very excited for you. I'm going to see Taylor Swift in concert in Sydney tomorrow, and I hope you have a fantastic time. And thank you so much, Harriet, for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. From Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, this is Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting, BIB, 24 hours a day.
Henry O'Donovan, around the world and down your street.
You say I don't understand, and I say I know you don't. We thought a cure would come through in time, now I fear it won't. Remember looking at this room, we loved it 'cause of the light. Now I just sit in the dark and wonder if it's time. Do I throw out everything we built or keep it? I'm getting tired, even for a phoenix. Always rising from the ashes, mending all her gashes. You might just have dealt the final blow. Stop. Stop, you're losing me. I can't find a pulse. My heart won't start anymore.
This is Ling Pang for Bondline Tunes International, and I'm delighted to introduce an interview with David Simmons, hosted by Jason Moyle, courtesy of Livewire.
Hello, I'm Jason Moyle. My guest on the programme today is David Simmons of Jad Records. Hello, David.
Hi there, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Right, so tell us a little bit about this project, because you've been working with Jad Records from its inception 50 years ago.
Yeah, very long time. Yeah, we, you know, these are pretty much under the wire, these recordings. Not a lot of people know about them. We did put some of them out in the 80s, and we're very gentle and sensitive around Bob's records. You know, the estate is something that you really have to respect. And the spirit of Bob is something that you have to respect. But we thought, you know, in the current world climate, Bob's message, it was a good time to put something out and see what happened, see whether people responded to it. So that's really the thinking behind it, yeah.
Okay, so you've had this in your archive for a long period of time, yeah. And this was a song, Selassie is the Chapel, from recorded between 1968 and 70.
Yes, about that. Yes. Yeah.
So, as you said, the record company decided to release it now. You've obviously got an archive of Bob's early recordings as well.
Yeah, we have about 300 recordings of Bob. He was very prolific in recording, very prolific writer. You know, he lived pretty much for music and his Rasta religion. Yeah, so, you know, we've got a lot of material.
So when did you start recording with Bob? Was it back in the late 60s?
Yes, late 60s. He was signed to a contract with Jadid, I think, in 1968 or 1969.
Okay. Because the actual song you've released, Selassie is the Chapel, is a very earthy recording, isn't it? It's very stripped back and it's
very
mellow.
Yeah, that's its beauty. Yeah, it's very stripped back. It's not what people would expect necessarily from Bob. But I think the drums on there, they're religious. I think they're called Nimambi drums. There's a very strong drum on there, which is a very special from sort of Rasta spiritual meetings. And Rita Marley is singing on the, Bob's wife is singing on the track. So yes, it's very stripped back. It's a religious piece of work, really.
As you mentioned, it is a religious piece of work, and the original song was written by Mortimer Piana, who personally greeted Haile Selassie in 1966 when he visited Jamaica.
Yes, yeah. Well, Mortimer was really Bob's mentor when he was a young man. Mortimer was a I met Mortimer on two or three occasions. He was a real mystic Rasta man and really leader of the Rastas. So to have that honour of going up the stairs of the plane to, you know, hold up Haile Selassie's arm, that was a pretty big deal. And when we brought Mortimer over here on one occasion, you know, sort of every Rasta in England sort of congregated around. So a lot of people in Notting Hill having a very good time, you know. So, but Mortimer really was the mentor to the young Bob. And sort of stayed involved with him. You know, the thing is, with Jamaica, things are, particularly around musicians, things are very loose. It's very different to how things are over here. You know, people drift in and out. Who actually wrote a song sometimes is very questionable because everybody contributes. So it's a challenge, but things tend to sort themselves out.
So, as you said, his music lives on today. He is probably most recognised vocalist in the world still, especially in the reggae category. So, you know, you worked with him from the very beginning. Did you know that he was going to have that impact?
No, nobody did. I mean, the person who really gave Bob his first sort of leg up in the industry was Johnny Nash, that you'll be familiar with, I Can See Clearly Now, which is a massive hit. And the album that Johnny was also on our label, and the album that Johnny put out had to support that single had two Bob Marley tracks on it, Stir It Up and can't remember the other one, maybe Guava Jelly. But Bob was a songwriter. And when Johnny went over with Danny Sims, who was the founder of Jad, to Jamaica to record, you know, a lot of musicians gravitated towards the studio because it was a big deal. And, you know, Bob sort of headed off with Johnny and played Johnny his songs. And it was Johnny that really spotted the potential of Bob as a songwriter, not necessarily as an artist. And of course, you know, Bob went on to write songs like One Love, I Shot the Sheriff, Get Up, Stand Up, you know, so he did write some phenomenal songs.
Yeah, and not just for himself, and obviously other people have covered his material as well.
Yeah.
And you mentioned One Love. It's been designated Song of the Millennium by the BBC, so that's the highest recommendation you can have, really, isn't it?
Yes. Well, we've always said that Bob is the most, has the highest stature, global stature of any artist, because although you have artists like Elvis and the Beatles, you know, if you went to India or Africa, it wouldn't mean very much, but you could go anywhere, any college around the world, you're going to find a Bob Marley poster, I don't know, China or Africa or what have you. You sit in a little cafe where the sun's shining, you're going to hear a Bob Marley song, but his visual appearance, his performance was so distinct and so powerful that we believe that it is genuinely the highest profile of any artist, and continues so today.
And of course, he's got the biopic coming up about him from Paramount Pictures called One Love, which is out this year. So have you seen
the trailer for it?
Oh, have you seen the trailer? Day. Yeah,
yeah. I was at the cinema, and yeah, the trailer came up, so it must be coming out into the cinemas fairly soon. Yeah.
Okay. And of course, the compilation album of Legend, which was in 1984, has been certified platinum 15 times over. So again, the kind of global impact that yes. he has had.
And then Catch a Fire is on its 50th anniversary right now. That's just been released with a slightly new cover on it. It's a constant catalogue. So you treat it. We don't overdo it. You know, you treat it carefully so that it maintains its integrity.
Okay, so are there going to be? I know you said that you're very careful and selective of the tracks that you release under Jad Records with his archive. Will there be more releases this year?
Yeah. I think we'll see how the public accept Selassie is the Chapel. We are working on another movie, which it doesn't feature Bob, but it touches. It's more around the founder of Jad Records, Danny Sims's life, which is a very, very colourful, interesting life. But Bob is part of that. So that will start shooting, hopefully, later this year with Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx has agreed to take the lead. So it's a big thing, but, you know, movies take a long time. So we've been on this one about 10 years. It takes a long time. You know, all these type of things take a very, very long time. So, yeah, but we might put out one or two more, put out one for the summer. Something like that, yeah.
When Bob was started writing back in 68 and he was working with the Wailers, and we kind of touched on this already, no one knew his impact, but did he know that his music had an impact on people?
Yes, I think, I don't know whether when Bob started he knew he was going to reach that global stardom, but then I don't think anybody would. But I think he was determined to send out his message through his writing, and then subsequently through his recording. It took a little while for the recording career to take off, but the songs were there. I mean, quite quickly, I think before Bob's first album was out, Eric Clapton did "I Shot the Sheriff," and Barbara Streisand did "Guava Jelly," to say Johnny Nash did "Stir It Up." So the songs were starting to work very, very well, but not necessarily associated with Bob. But I think he was very, yes, he was just totally dedicated to his to his music and his religion, really. And I think he felt that the two together would something great would happen. Yeah.
Brilliant. So, Paul, thank you so much for talking to me today about this. Good luck with Selassie is the Chapel, which is it out now, that song?
Yes, it is. Yes.
And on all platforms, can people buy
all
it?
All platforms, yeah. I was going to say in all good record shops, but you can't say that anymore. Because
Is there a physical thing for that? Is there a vinyl?
There is one. I think you can buy on Amazon, yeah. We did a limited number of physical copies, so I think you can get them on Amazon, yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. So, well, I look forward, I've heard it. It's, as I say, it's a lovely track. And I look forward to hearing more this year as well. So thank you very much, David.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Hail Selassie is the Selassie.
of June.
Listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting on Valley FM in Canberra, 89.5 FM, World FM, 88.2 FM, in Tawa near Wellington in New Zealand. And of course, we welcome our friends across the world, particularly North America and Europe. And talking about such things as North America, I'm joined by Rona Seagrave, who's in Winnipeg, fondly known by me as The Peg. Ronan, welcome back to the show.
Good evening, Henry.
Gosh, you know, is there a federal election coming up in Canada? Or, has a date been set?
Well, the situation, Henry, there has to be one by July 2025. I mean, there was a lot of speculation that the current government, which is a liberal minority government, propped up by the sort of left-wing NDP government and a sort of supply arrangement might, you know, start to fall apart. I mean, there were signs of that happening, but no, they've cut a deal, Henry, in the last week around something called PharmaCare, which is essentially a
Medicare federal, kind of thing?
Yeah, a federal provincial drugs plan that they're going to spend billions of dollars on and roll that out over the next year or two. So that's been enough for the leader of the NDP, Jagmeet Singh, to sort of stick with the arrangement. Now, both of those leaders, Henry, would have pretty good reasons for avoiding an election right now. The Liberals are 20 points behind the Conservatives and would be facing a certain defeat. The NDP wouldn't really go anywhere, Henry. They might, you know, lose a seat or two, but there wouldn't be any kind of dramatic gains or anything like that here. So both of them, Henry, I think had pretty good reasons of saying, no, we definitely don't want an election now.
Oh, Ronan, it's not about the people, is it? It's about them,
these
politicians. Now, I've got some funny headlines today, and I love quoting Politico.com, and they don't mess around. And the headline is, How Justin Trudeau lost his grip. The Prime Minister's bleak reality. Canadians just don't like him anymore. Despite all that, he's kind of doing okay in the polls, by the sounds of it.
Well, he's 20 points down. I mean, he would certainly, Henry, you know, if there was
that's
an election
a lot
tomorrow, in fact, yeah, he'd almost certainly lose it. I mean, some say the Liberals would lose up to 120 seats. I mean, I think it would be a disaster.
For some reason, I thought that the NDP were doing quite well. Have I got all this wrong?
No, the NDP are sort of flatlining, Henry. They wouldn't, you know, either gain any seats or lose any. It would be a similar result. They have around, I think, 29 seats. I think the polls have them coming back with 27. But the Liberals would are on course, Henry, for losing up to 120 seats, most of which would go to the Conservatives, who would form a comfortable majority government. So I think that a number of issues with Trudeau. One has been sort of a whole bunch of scandals and things that have happened over the course of his government. I think a view that he's sort of elitist and out of touch is another perception of him. You know, he's been Prime Minister, Henry, for over 8 years at this point.
Really?
People are just kind of
we mustn't forget that his father was also Prime Minister, and there tends to be some kind of, you know, people would go, well, nepotism, is that the term?
Well, certainly, yes, there's the infamous Trudeau Trust Fund. So, but yeah, I think people have just started getting tired of the soap opera with all the business, Henry. Then last year it was sort of marriage breakup.
Mm.
The Liberals kind of had a decision really last year to decide whether A, to ditch him, or Justin Trudeau decided he'd had enough, but neither happened. And I think it's almost certain they will go into the election with him. At the moment, it's an election he seems destined to lose.
Canada's Conservatives, tell me about Pierre Poilievre. What's he about?
He's definitely one of the populist variety, Henry. I mean, he won the last leadership election, you know, supporting the truckers who, you know, the convoy of truck drivers, you know, protesting about COVID-19 restrictions. He's come out again recently, Henry, around sort of transgender issue. I mean, why politicians get into this stuff is beyond me. But again, going on about bathrooms and transgender athletes, and, you know, getting involved as to when, you know, children should have surgery or not. I mean, these for me are matters for medical professionals and the families involved, not for politicians to be wading in. But he's gone on that kind of front. So the problem with that stuff, Henry, is that it doesn't play that well with you know, a lot of female professional voters who are a very key voting demographic in elections and particularly in suburban ridings outside Toronto, but very much of the populist variety. He certainly tacked the Conservatives a little bit further to the right. But at this point, Henry, I think the Conservatives could stick up a tin of paint and probably be comfortable with winning the election.
And of course,
be honest with you.
Sorry, Poilievre's, he likes to repeat, I mean, this is his trap line, really. Canada is broken. High inflation, runaway grocery prices, rising mortgage rates and a housing crisis help make the case, according to Politico. Do you reckon he's got a chance here? You know, this is interesting to me because politics, a week is a long time in politics, and Trudeau is obviously slipping up.
I think so, Henry. I mean, they use a phrase in Canada, sort of kick the bums out election. And it could be more of that than people that are madly in love with Pierre Poilievre. I mean, Trudeau's hope is that the economic things, indicators improve. I mean, inflation is coming down slowly. The talk of interest rates may be decreasing in a few months' time. So maybe those things start to turn a bit around in Trudeau's favour and less attack that Poilievre can take in attacking him. But I just think, Henry, it just might be the Canadians are just sick of Trudeau and sick of the government.
But, you know, it's the same.
Want to change.
Yeah, it's the same in Australia. You know, when there was 13 years of the right-wing Liberal Party, Liberal is right-wing if you're listening in North America, in Australia it's right-wing, and, you know, people, and some commentator made a very interesting point. He just said people are sick of the same thing. And I just want to talk about this retired nine-term MP, Wayne Easter. Now, he's a former chair of the House Finance Committee. He says, I'm a member of the Liberal Party. I'm not a member of the Justin Trudeau movement. That's a telling thing, isn't it?
At least he knows what party he's a member of. I mean, the Justin Trudeau movement, I mean, there is some... there always is, you know, some disgruntlement among particularly sort of backbench Liberal MPs, those that have not made it into cabinet. I think, you know, the war in Gaza has proved to be quite a divisive issue for the Liberals. Trudeau sort of ended up sort of not pleasing anybody by trying to sort of tread a line here by calling for ceasefires while
didn't he go
support for Israel.
Did he go to Ukraine as well recently, or am I imagining?
Yes, he was. He was in Ukraine last Sunday. You know, offering support. He was announcing, you know, several more billions of dollars of aid from Canada in terms of weaponry and other things that we're giving to Ukraine. I think Canada, in fairness, Trudeau's support and Canada's support for Ukraine has been pretty rock solid. The Gaza issue has just proved to be, the war there has just proved to be much more divisive. And on the one hand, he's got a sort of block of Jewish MPs in his party who are not happy with sort of anything they see as sort of pandering to Hamas. And on the other, you know, some Asian MPs of Asian origin who you know, may be more sympathetic to the Palestinians, so that he's ended up sort of really pleasing nobody in his party and sort of trying to tread a line around this.
Now, we'll talk in a minute about US politics and, you know, how Biden has all the great results of, you know, unemployment and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And just like him, let's look at Justin Trudeau 8 years on. Tangible achievements, legalization of marijuana, of course they followed the US on that one. A national child care program seeks to bring down fees to $10 a day Canadian. and an immigration policy that currently welcomes 500,000 newcomers to Canada each year. He's been doing good things, but does that matter?
No, I think there are two things that are main things that I think Canadians are concerned about. We can talk about the economy, but as I say, I think that's likely to tick up a bit between now and the election. One is housing. I mean, it's viewed as a sort of national crisis at this point, and it's a really very simple problem. There just isn't enough affordable housing. People are raising issues, as you say, Henry, about sort of 500,000 people coming in and, you know, putting in ever more pressure on the housing stock. We have sky high, some of the most expensive housing prices in the world in cities like Vancouver and Toronto. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, there's a public perception that whatever they're doing is just completely inadequate in response to that. Yeah. I think the second issue that Canadians are concerned about is debt and the ever-growing budget deficits and government debt and what Canadians might see is an awful lot of wasteful spending, Henry. There's an ongoing, and this is a really typical Canadian one, an ongoing controversy around something called the ArriveCan app. And essentially what this is, Henry, you know, when you arrive in Canada, or listeners, if you arrive in any country, you've got to do a customs declaration.
And, yes.
The ArriveCan app allowed you to do that. It also allowed automated processing at the time of sort of COVID-19 vaccine requirements. Now, they're obviously not in place now, but the customs piece is. And all sorts of issues arose, Henry, around that there didn't seem to be any kind of procurement or, you know, issuing a tender or anything like that. It was sort of sole sourced to a company. They then sort of outsourced the work to other people. There seemed to be incredibly poor oversight. There a couple of very senior civil servants have been sort of suspended without pay, and they were appearing at a committee next week extremely angry, saying that a report into the matter, which basically eviscerated the government and accused them of wasting millions of dollars on this, these civil servants weren't happy and felt they were being scapegoated. So that's just an example, Henry, of that and a number of other issues where people just see billions of dollars in wasteful spending. There was also, I can't remember, I think it's even up as high as $8 billion, Henry, but it was, you know, money sent in sort of COVID benefits, you know, people who were out of work and applied for something called the CERB. But because, Henry, there were so many people applying for it, there weren't really any checks at all on people, and they just handed out money. And now the government's estimated that about 8 billion of this shouldn't have been handed out, and they're trying to claw it back.
Of course, they never will. I tell you what, globally, COVID has been overspent on in many countries. You know, I've asked you before, Ronan, if you can vote in Canada, and I keep asking you the same question.
Yes, I can.
You can vote in Canada, yes?
Yes, no, I'm now a citizen, so yes, I...
Oh, that's recently.
Just last year, I voted for the first time in a provincial election here in Manitoba back last October. So come... most likely now, Henry, 2025, I'll cast my first ballot in a federal election.
How exciting. I think that's exciting.
I'm not going to tell listeners who I'm voting for.
No,
I'm not
okay. It's your business and no one else's.
From the golden sands of Bondi Beach to the world, this is Bondi Tunes International.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Ronan Seagrave in Winnipeg, the Peg, in Canada. He's one of our North American correspondents. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, for Bondi Tunes International. Let's switch to US politics, and I'm loving quoting newspapers at the moment, Ronan. CNN Politics writes a headline, Trump declares himself a political dissident at CPAC, capping a conference catered to conspiracies. Now, explain CPAC for our listeners, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, CPAC is we've been using the word conservative here. It's, you know, it stands for Conservative Political Action Committee, but you're quite right, Henry. It is a conservatism of a hard and extreme right nature, and very much dominated by Trumpers, by people who really believe Donald Trump won the 2020 election and believe his lies on that, and believe, you know, conspiracy theories. I mean, some of what was going on, Henry, was, as vicious as, frankly, racist as this was, there was actually a panel that was entitled Catfight, I'm not making this up, by the way, listen, it's entitled Catfight.
Yes.
And there was this, supposedly a serious debate that at the Democratic convention, Joe Biden wouldn't be nominated, and a catfight would break out between supporters of Michelle Obama, for listeners' benefit, has absolutely no interest whatsoever in running for president.
But is that right? Yeah.
A catfight between Michelle Obama and Kamala Harris. I mean, the other thing, Henry, that was weird about this event was that the former British Prime Minister, and she just about was for about 30 days.
Truss?
Liz Truss, yep. She turned up, again, spouting quackadoo conspiracy theories. In her case, Henry, she was alleging that the British deep state, whatever that is, was involved in her
short term.
She proceeded then to endorse Trump and said the world would be safer if Donald Trump was president. I'm not sure whether Liz is aware that you know, Donald cozies up to dictators and is threatening not to defend NATO countries and how that would really make the world safer. So it was absolutely nuts, Henry, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've often wondered about this. Obviously, they, you know, the Democrat Party, they can't change their leader. It's way too late for that because the federal election's in November. But I often wonder if Kamala Harris would have been a better... I'm saying this because...
I don't think so, Henry. No,
okay.
I think...
Why?
I don't think Kamala... I think there would be a real risk if Kamala Harris isn't Donald Trump. I just don't think she's been that effective as a vice president, Henry. I think there are other Democrats. You know, I look at Gretchen Kitchener, governor of North Dakota. I would look at Gavin Newsom in California. These are people that I think would be much more... you know, credible presidential candidates. I mean, the issue for the Democrats is there's an alternative story, Henry, here that's not a bad one. That, you know, Joe Biden came out at his age and defeated Donald Trump and saved Donald Trump, saved America from a second Donald Trump presidency. And there was a view, Henry, back at that time that he'd only serve one term because of his age. Yes. And I think there was a narrative for him to say, I'm just going to serve one term. I'm going to throw it open to Democratic primaries for people to succeed me. I don't think even he would be anointing Kamala Harris because they don't get on, apparently. So
is that right? Oh, dear.
Apparently not, no. No, he doesn't have much confidence in her. So that didn't happen. And we now have, you know, the Democrats. You know, there was another thing the other night, Henry, where, again, Biden confused Putin with Xi of China. Now, I'm not saying that Joe Biden has dementia or anything like that, but he's certainly showing his age, and that can't be denied. And I just think I'm not, Henry, even at this point, 100% convinced that Biden will be the candidate, or something might happen. Maybe he has an illness or something. There's just something might happen that says, look, he just can't run.
That's a very interesting point, Ronan. But what if yeah. I mean, this guy's 81, is he? I mean, and just to mention, of course, Trump has screwed up in stuff he thought he was up against.
Trump is definitely showing signs of
poverty. Yeah, because
talking about his wife Mercedes.
That's the latest. Tell us about that. And also, he mentioned... He thought that he was, you know, up against a previous President Obama at another
Obama
speech.
Yeah, well, that was the other theme of that there were chants at CPAC that former President Obama should be locked up for goodness knows what. But yes, I mean, Trump has been showing cognitive decline around his speech, around slurring speech, around, as you say, thinking he defeated Barack Obama. Thinking actually that he defeated George W. Bush, not Jeb Bush, in the primary. So,
yes.
And then this gaffe where he, admittedly, Henry, he doesn't seem to see her terribly often, if at all, because we never see her. He referred to his wife Melania as Mercedes, and
there's something very weird about that.
I mean, so he's definitely showing signs of cognitive decline. All that being said, Henry,
he's got a lot of hubris.
He's got a lot of hubris. He's, unless something dramatic happens, he's going to be the Republican nominee. Now, what I think is really interesting, he defeated Nikki Haley. She's still in the race. In her own state.
We're talking about South, she lost in her own state of South Carolina, of course.
South Carolina. Now, but what's interesting...
But it's a Republican state anyway, isn't it?
It's a Republican state. When you dig into the numbers, Trump won 60-40. Now, people were saying he was going to win by 80-20 and it was going to be sort of an annihilation. It didn't turn into that. But when you dig into... 40% is still significant. And when you dig into Nikki Haley's numbers, 59% of those Republicans who voted for Nikki Haley said they would never vote for Trump. So, you know, he would go into an election, Henry, where, you know, he'd have his base, but he seems to have singularly very little appeal to, A, you know, independent voters, previously more sort of moderate Republican voters, women in relation to the views he's taken on abortion. The risk here for the Democrats is that this election is almost impossible to lose, but it just might be if they run Joe Biden, because suddenly people, you know, start getting concerned about his age and his capability and capacity to discharge the office. Now, at the end of the day, Henry, I don't think that would be enough. And I think Biden would win the election, but it's a risk. But having said that, I still think there is maybe a 25-30% chance that Joe Biden isn't the nominee and that something happens that is just too much and they need to throw it open to a convention or whatever. You know?
It's 8 months away. And you know, I just want to quote the wonderful CNN Politics website. The striking choice of words delivered at a speech of the Conservative Political Action CPAC comes just days after Trump likened his legal plight, to get this, to Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Just for listeners to reflect, how grotesquely offensive that is. I mean, Navalny was murdered, let's be clear about it, murdered, no doubt, in Putin's orders. And for the simple reason of wanting democracy in Russia and free and fair elections, and the man was jailed in a sort of penal colony in Siberia. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But he's done this before, Henry. I mean, he's compared himself to Nelson Mandela, you know?
Yeah.
As insane as that is. But this is what Trump does. He constantly portrays himself as some kind of sort of victim here, that it's, you know, he's been victimized, he's been persecuted.
It's very narcissistic, isn't it?
He's facing, obviously, horrendous problems. We've got, obviously, these criminal trials coming up. And obviously
lots of money.
Civil judgments over $500 million. So
Will that have an impact on him?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think he doesn't have the money, Henry, and that's why he's busy trying to appeal this and kick this. I mean, he simply doesn't have the money.
He's choked in New York, isn't he? I mean, really, they've choked
him
in New York.
Yeah, I mean, people are saying that even buildings could be seized here to sort of pay the debt. He doesn't have it, Henry. And his best bet is to you know, kick this down and having appeals and dragging it out. Maybe trying to do merchandising through his campaign and that kind of thing. But at the moment, I mean, he just doesn't have the money. You know?
I'd love to interview Michael Moore, who in 2016 predicted a Trump win in that federal election in America. I'd love to know what he's thinking, because, you know, I know some people, and they're not conservative people in America, but they're people who actually think Trump could win this election.
I mean, he could. I think it's unlikely, but I think he could. And I think that the risk for the Democrats here, that if it's Biden, that's just going, you know, the gaffes and his age. And I just think that becoming perhaps Americans thinking just like, there's no way this guy's going to see out a second term. We don't want Kamala Harris. So, but I don't know. At the moment, I don't see the Democrats, the other leadership of the party, sort of intervening here. But I think if something were to happen around an illness or something, then I think the opportunity would be taken to, you know, suggest that he doesn't run and then have probably an open convention or some sort of system, Henry, where maybe somebody like Gavin Newsom emerges as a candidate. You know,
I've got to just ask you about Taylor Swift. I can't help it. You know,
She's in Australia, Henry, isn't she?
She was. She left, and I said, "How is Australia?
Okay.
How will Australia survive without her? I interviewed a 12-year-old girl, which is in the first hour of this show, who was about to go to see Taylor Swift. And I have to say, you know, I'll call it. I was very impressed because I had to do some research. I mean, 12-year-old girls, you've got a teenage daughter. You know,
yes.
This girl is 12. My God, she is so well-spoken and knowledgeable. Absolutely. I was feeling really threatened. They say don't work with children or animals, but, you know, but she was great. She was great. And it was fascinating because I did a bit of research on Taylor Swift, and I have to admit, you know, she is very impressive. I don't know any of her music. Is your teenager, is she a Swiftie?
No, I wouldn't say she was, I wouldn't describe her as a Swiftie. I mean, she was probably a few years when she was 11 or 12, kind of, you know, listening to Taylor Swift. She's kind of gone into a more gothic phase, Henry.
What age is she now?
16, yeah.
Oh, okay, so, well, she's probably past it then, yeah.
Slipknot and kind of, you know, thrash metal bands like that. But I'd almost prefer it was Taylor Swift. But
That's great.
Taylor Swift has, I think, started becoming a factor in the US presidential elections.
That's the reason I asked, Ronan. That's the reason I asked.
Yeah, you know, it is assumed, well, but I don't think it needs to be an assumption, she will definitely endorse Joe Biden or whoever the Democratic candidate is, but assuming it's Joe Biden, she's going to endorse Joe Biden. She's been pretty vehement about her opposition to Trump. I mean, she obviously has been even more in the public eye in the US because of her boyfriend, who is the Kansas City Chiefs, who won the Super Bowl there a couple of weeks ago, a Kansas City Chiefs tight end, Travis Kelce, and Taylor Swift was, this relationship, Henry, started sort of in September, and Taylor Swift has been attending a number of games of the Kansas City Chiefs, and she also attended the Super Bowl, and there's been sort of footage of them embracing on the pitch. There's a lot of footage, Henry, actually a lot of it's quite funny, of Taylor Swift, and at the Super Bowl, Henry, present were Travis Kelce's parents and his brother Jason Kelce, who plays for the Philadelphia Eagles, who decided to sort of parade around in a mask and get absolutely hammered at the party. But Taylor really? Swift also brought her parents, and there's actually a funny footage of her at the party. The camera pans on her parents and then pans on to Taylor Swift, who sort of throws her eyes saying, "What was I thinking?" But at this after, you know, victory party of the Kansas City Chiefs, and the game was in Las Vegas, so they were in a nightclub, Marshmello, with a bucket on his head, was DJing it, and there's lots of footage of Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce dancing. A lot of people have noted that at one point Taylor Swift is holding three different drinks and seems to be drinking all of them and having a really good time. But I think what's interesting about the footage is it's very natural and. As even Jason Kelce said, it's just two people who are in love, and whatever else you want to say about it, that's what it is. But, headlines, Henry, about, you know, people saying that you know, the camera was constantly cutting to Taylor Swift. Well, it only did for about 60 seconds during a four-hour game, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting, the whole MAGA thing, where these supporters of Donald Trump might be torn a bit, because, you know, Taylor Swift is a juggernaut, a musical juggernaut around the world, and you know, I just wonder if the MAGA supporters, many of which who would be fans of Taylor Swift, are torn because she's obviously going to vote.
Oh
Biden.
Yeah, I mean, they're angry about this. I mean, the American football is seen as kind of, you know, sort of conservative, and
yes,
even though, you know, 75% of the players are black, but also Travis Kelce is known actually to have quite liberal views and progressive views. He fronted a national TV advertising campaign urging people to get COVID-19 boosters. So that immediately put him in the ire of the MAGA brigade. He also started to invest in sort of more liberal independent filmmaking and things like that. So, I mean, it's clear that his political views are probably very much aligned with Taylor's. So, but yes, there has been a hardcore who thinks that, you know, the NFL should be about the military and country and Western music and Christian values.
Indeed.
Not okay. Possibly in that order, but yeah.
No, yes. I know where you're coming from. Ronan, it's always fantastic to pick your brains. Thank you for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
It's a pleasure as always, Henry. Take care.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.